All right, we have Amit Nair joining today. Thanks for coming back. It's been a little while since we chatted, and so I'm looking forward to our conversation today.
Yeah, I'm really happy to be here. Thanks for having me back. Looking forward to this discussion.
Cool. So why don't you jump right into it with your career path since day zero with technology?
Sure. I'll go all the way back to in school, I was always into computers. I was always kind of good at logic, math, reasoning, but I went to college and thought I wanted to do biology, but I was always like in the computer lab in college and taking some computer classes on the side. Came out of college in like in the mid 90s, and I was kind of tinkering around with a biology degree, didn't know really what to do with it. Back then there was like Y2K, it was hot, the dot-com boom was happening. I'm aging myself here, of course, but I decided, hey, I think I can make a career out of this. I'm going to make a run at it. So I went and took some like serious computer science courses, and then just started applying for jobs. And I landed a job with a consulting firm that was really doing like an entry level program with their customers and allowing them to bring on like junior engineers and kind of teach them on the job. And then the customer got like a discount rate for that. But they find these talented. Hopefully talented people and like train them up. And then that consulting firm would have this like bench of staff. So I started there, started programming and like realized I loved it. I thought I was getting really good feedback from my managers and from my peers. I was solving problems. It was like everything I was kind of built to do and just didn't know. So I moved on from there to, that was mostly like, if you can believe it, I hate to admit this, but it is what it is. It was back working on a big banking system that was like a mainframe application, COBOL CICS. But it was a foot in the door for me to start learning how to be an engineer. I quickly wanted to like move out of the mainframe and move to more of a client server setup and found some startups in Denver. Most of my career was launched in Denver. And then kind of went to a startup, was more like Linux-based AI. It was more AIX back then, IBM AIX and Windows Server. But it was a startup, a client server. Enjoyed that. The startup kind of didn't work out. It was even back in the 90s, startups were failing. And then moved on to a little bit more well-established company. It was I guess early stages of a SaaS. We were building products and hosting them for telecommunications, convergent telecommunications companies. That was all like C++ back end, Visual C++ front end, software engineer, moved kind of into senior software engineer. It was all Windows Server, IBM AIX, so like Linux predecessors, Unix back end, Solaris, stuff like that. Out of there, I spent about 4.5 years there, really honed my skills as an engineer. And then a friend of mine came calling and went back into like a startup again and joined a really cool company where we started doing some C# .NET. First lines of code, brand new startup, fintech, I guess wasn't really a thing back then, but that's what we were building. And really honed my skills as a senior engineer and then started moving into technical leadership. There was a need for more technical leadership on our team. Did that for a couple of years and then just kind of naturally moved into management. I was growing a little tired of coding. I was getting a little bit, I was more interested in scaling my skills, scaling my impact through others. I was really enjoying the lead part of things more than the like engineering part of things. I found that I was good with people. I was able to teach and coach and mentor. So I jumped headfirst into management. And back then, you didn't really have a career path that branched. You had to like go into management to advance, unlike some roles today. So I went into management there, and then kind of the rest is history. Moved into like a larger company after that as a manager of engineering. That was a SaaS also, where we were doing distance learning, online learning for colleges and universities, and even K-12. Moved out of there to move up in my career to a more of a director or leadership role at another software company. And then we decided to move to LA. Really glad we did. Landed as a director level at a large retailer in LA, focusing mostly on cloud architecture, platform services, really helping them kind of take over. Is it bringing some best practices from the software engineering world into how they wanted to build their online presence in the form of e-commerce. Came out of there and went to GoDaddy as a director of engineering, moved up to VP of engineering there. That was a lot of leading many teams now at scale, at a senior level, in a well-known company, and then GoDaddy went public and kind of looked around and said, hey, you know, I don't really have much of a, you know, I will never be like the CTO of this company of GoDaddy, so I'm going to move on to a smaller org. And I tend to find my niche in a smaller org. Went into vice president of technology at a ad tech company here in LA. And then from there, found myself here at Flowcast, where I am today, where I'm vice president of engineering. We're a B2B SaaS building closed management software for accountants to close the books monthly, quarterly, annually.
Great. Thanks for that. That's a really good summary and a lot of different roles and it pretty much widening all the way throughout. So that's great. So talk about what it was like going between those early management jobs when you had maybe a small team to when you had maybe some managers underneath you and a division and so forth as a director, maybe, et cetera. Like, talk about that transition for yourself and kind of like, what was that growth like for you?
Yeah, it's an interesting challenge leading leaders. When you're leading the individual contributors directly, you can have near real time immediate impact, right? You're in their scrum, or whatever process they're using, Kanban or waterfall way back in the day. But you have like kind of a much more immediate gratification or kind of feedback loop of whether your kind of suggestions or coaching or mentoring is benefiting the team. So when you're very, you know, very much still in the code, you can speak in terms that everybody understands, because you know that sub routine, you know that class, you know that module, I think it's easier for the engineers to relate to you. Now move a degree of separation from the individual contributors, and you're trying to lead leaders and try to like lead through them. And you get the telephone game in terms of communication challenges back and forth. But if you find really great people that are in management for the right reasons, which is to benefit people and their growth and enable them through servant leadership or whatever their style may be to be successful and understand that, you know, we stand on the shoulders of the giants, of the people that are actually building the systems, and we're there to help enable them and blaze a path. If you find kind of leaders that believe in that vision as well, it gets a lot easier. What I found was if you had a kind of a real disagreement on leadership style or approach, not that it has to be homogenous, it can be a challenge and get confusing for the engineers who outnumber you, and really you're there for their benefit at the end of the day. So it was a challenge, but it was a fun challenge.
Yeah, definitely. I've seen a couple schools of thought there where some people are like, well, you know, to do my impact, I did it within my own, small team. And maybe by doing that, I'm leading by example. I'm going to make other people, my peers or my guild of other directors or whatever, engineer managers potentially, want to also do that. And then I look at the other perspectives, which is like, well, no, it's an imperative if somebody higher up in the org, whether it's a VP of engineering or head of technology or whatever, and it trickles down through the org. And like you said earlier, you try and find management that when you hire them, they already sort of believe in this. But if it's reinforced, it's going to happen within the org. If you have sort of a buck stops here mentality as a, engineering manager like a SVP of engineering or CTO or whatever, it should stop with you when whenever anybody is underserved or there's surprises, there's problems in the org or organizational debt, et cetera. Anyhow.
I totally agree with that. I think leading by example is something that I try to do every day. And I'm never, you know, no problem is too big or too small for me to try to help and solve, right? So I think you have to be willing to kind of roll up your sleeves and engage on whatever level you need to benefit your team and help with communicating that vision and or helping with any kind of corrections or especially helping with reward or acknowledgement for sure. So you can't totally delegate those responsibilities to others. I think it's very important that you stay in touch, and you should know everybody's name on your team in your department, no matter how big it is kind of a rule of thumb for me. So I try to interview everyone if I can. If not, I'm at least in know of their resume, and I definitely have a meeting with them their first week. I just want to know everyone and make a personal relationship with them so that they know that I'm there for them as well.
That's great. So do you notice when you're interviewing them, are they asking you questions too about your, you know, what's it going to be like to work there? Or what kind of things do people do to grow there, et cetera? Are you getting these from your candidates?
Yes, I find, you know, we always try to leave time for people to ask us questions. That's how we kind of structure our interviews. Everybody leaves a window. I feel like we just want to hear, we want to give the candidate an opportunity to interview us, right? It's a two-way conversation. It's not just about us seeing if they're a good fit for us. It's about them seeing if we're a good fit for them. And so I do get a lot of interesting questions when I'm interviewing people at all levels. And they often want to know, you know, sometimes they're asking questions about what's the kind of company trajectory. You know, they have an opportunity to ask someone that's pretty high up in the org, or high up, whatever that means. And so maybe they want to know, like, hey, where's the company going? What's the vision? What's the likelihood of success? Or some people want to know, hey, what's your philosophy on what's your cultural philosophy? What kind of culture do you believe in? Some might want to know, you know, what's your process or what's the big challenges your engineering team's facing? What's the roadmap for engineering? Those are the more interesting questions. You know, and then there's kind of the standard, hey, why do you work here? But you can always turn that one into also an interesting conversation. If you believe in what you're doing, you can really impart on them why you're doing it and why it's important.
Yeah, absolutely. And to the extent that you can externalize those things into engineer blogs, videos, interviews of your engineers, the environment, open source contributions, speaking at meetups and conferences, all of this stuff also gets that out there. And some of the best open source companies are something else too, like Etsy or whatever they, you know, et cetera. Cool. So throughout these different organizations that you've been in, did you have some that had a higher degree of buy-in or a lesser degree of buy-in with actually acknowledging the individual's growth? Like, were there any places where it was endemic in the culture?
I mean, I think where company-wide, I think it may have varied. I think something important to me is always at whatever kind of sphere of influence I have that having the understanding that everybody's there for their own reasons and they're not, it's not uniform. It's not homogenous. We're all there for different reasons. And at the end of the day, this is their career. This is their career path. This is their livelihood. And I feel a real obligation to, as best I can, trying to find a way to tap into what intrinsically motivates each individual, either through, you know, my own interactions with them or through our leadership's interactions with them, and understand that and show them present them a path where they can be successful in a career within your org. Because if you don't, they're going to go somewhere else to find it. But believing in the career path of the people in your org and having opportunities to learn and grow is extremely important to me. And I'd say the company I'm in, the organization I'm in right now at Flowcast is, I would say it's ubiquitous. I think all of our leaders understand this at the root, that our people are the most important asset. I hate really putting it that way. They're the most important part of our business. And we need to ensure that if we want the great ones to stay with us for longevity, that we need to give them opportunities to grow. They should not stagnate.
And so yeah, excellent.
Those cross those plans for everyone.
Great. And that's a good segue. You said longevity. So I look at growth like sort of on a quarterly basis. It's sort of like a performance plan. And in terms of good one-on-ones and stuff, you might set up stretch goals outside of your team goals, which map to like what you want to do, which also align with the company ideally, and ideally your mentors aligning your goals with your own career path. But then growth happens in the short run or in a quarterly basis, but really you're trying to help them navigate and vector whichever way they want. And that can change. So at what level have you seen career management fold into the equation, and who's doing it? What's the tactics and strategies there?
Yeah, sure. What we've done is first create a framework or a structure for it. And you can find examples of them all over the place. Some people call them like dual ladder career paths or there's a lot of names for them, but we feel that like setting up a set of attributes that we feel are important for a role type, and there are different role types, whether there's software engineers, whether they're QA engineers, whether they're, I guess, DevOps engineers, security engineers, managers, that you should have. You should define the levels or the steps in a career that are important to you in your org. And then the attributes that are important across the board that are important at all those levels. And then be able to show some examples of how they can move ahead. If leadership's important to you in your org, then put it in your documentation and discuss that with your personnel and make that important and show how, you can grow, show clear examples of assuming more leadership as you become more senior. Say a senior engineer, you expect to be leading more larger projects or more people than you might expect, a first-time engineer, of course. And you have to show that continuum. And I think first showing that and doing that kind of together to get their buy-in is important. That's what's worked well for us, I feel. And then your managers need – the managers of those individual contributors or the people that are reporting to you, the managers that report to you if you're a senior leader, you need to have that conversation with them either quarterly or at least three times a year and refer back to that framework and say, hey, you're at this step or path or level. You're a software engineer three. These are the things that, we both agree you're really good at, and these are the things we both agree you want to improve on. You don't have to be great at all of them. Here's some opportunities. We'll look for some opportunities for you to practice those skills. You can't just wake up one day and be a CTO. You have to practice and hone those skills. It's like learning an instrument, perhaps. You can't just sit down and be a virtuoso. A piano. You have to do the work, and so that takes some time. And you have to have opportunities to practice leadership or the harder skills of like programming, maybe taking on building a whole subsystem or something versus just a function or a class. So we try to find those opportunities, and we try to work with those, and we want to map that to their interest as well. So that's kind of how we do it. I don't know if that made a ton of sense, but
it makes a ton of really sense.
Communicating with your people, what interests them, align to that career path, and then finding those opportunities, making sure they understand this is an opportunity that you're giving them to stretch themselves, and then discussing how they did, and then they have to be given more and more opportunities to do that, and then they will master it over time.
Yeah, excellent. So let's talk about outsized growth, meaning like some people may start as peers. A good example from one of the last interviews was somebody who essentially graduated college with somebody else. They were a friend forever, and that person founded like five or six really successful companies. And he had went and worked through most of them, et cetera. Or people who join an org at the same time, at the same level, but then they have drastically different directions, but they're both successful in different directions, et cetera. You know, people who go through their arc faster than the average is what I'm looking for. So do you have any, you know, success stories of people you've seen come into your org and either they went out of your org much higher or they're still there and they're like just crushing it?
Yeah, sure. So I think that, you know, if I was, I'll focus on, I've definitely had circumstances where, you know, I've been proud of folks that have grown within our org and then decided that it was their opportunity to try something else. I think that that is kind of important at times, is to try to get another look, I guess, another org to see if you can hone your skills, and they come in at a higher level and seem to be very successful. I think some of the examples that I'm most excited about are some of the folks that I've seen in our current org at Flowcast. We have some software engineers. So let me back up. Our software is for accountants, right? So we're a platform for them to help them take some of the drudgery out of closing the books. It's a very labor-intensive process at times, a manual labor-intensive process at times. And so it's been very interesting to see people in our organization coming out of the CPA world, really making career changes. They'd be very successful, certified public accountants. And CPA is a fairly traditionally non-technical demographic. I wouldn't want to stereotype anyone, but you know, at the risk of that, it's not known to be high tech. But we have some software engineers in our org that have just excelled, not just because they're grounded in some of the fundamental domain, but they've just moved into software engineering and just moved up quickly, and now are really impacting broad spectrums of our organizations, either through product management, through software engineering, through customer support, customer success, through high levels of sales, marketing. I mean, there's no part of our organization where there isn't a former CPA, and to see how diverse they've been able to like make a transition into roles you may not think that they would have otherwise been successful at, or even they might not have thought that they could be as successful as they could, has
That's
been tremendous.
great. That's great. And you realize that's quite the adjective there when you say they excelled. When you're talking about software for accountants, it's like, you mean they got really good at Excel?
Oh, no,
I'm
yes.
kidding. I'm kidding. No, that's a great
They're
one.
also very good at Excel, to make another stereotype.
Right.
They've exceeded all expectations beyond our wildest dreams, and they continue to grow and talk
Yeah.
about like kind of out. Some of them have really outpaced their peer group.
Yep.
Some folks that have started at the same time.
Absolutely. That's great. Okay, so with respect to what you're doing right now at Flowcast as VP of Engineering, do you have anything mandated with your directors or whoever you oversee to make sure these things are happening, or is it happening already? Is it organic? How does that happen in your org right now?
The kind of the career path curation for our teams.
Well, growth too, yeah.
Growth. Yeah, I mean, it's something that I bring up with them. I try to, you know, I hold myself to the same standard I would hold them to. So I try to, you know, in my one-on-ones with them, I try to, you know, bring it up. So anybody new we onboard, first of all, we sit down with them, we explain to them where they're at on the career path based on their interview. And it's very hard to glean, like, are you a one, two, three, whatever numbering or alphabet scheme you use or title scheme you use. It's very hard to assess in an interview. It's not perfect. So we say, hey, this is where we're starting you. And we explain to them, and we provide them access to the career path to start with. And then we see how they do, and then we right size them after that. We never move anyone down. We would only move them up. That's our promise to them in terms of like bringing them on brand new. And then the folks that we have, and then we continue that, you know, like I said, at least three times a year, and then in like an official review cycle at least once a year. And then the way that I kind of ensure that that's happening is we just have onboarding checklists and requirements. Then after they're in the org, so we have people that have been here or now they're going along in their career, I have just kind of a reminder with each of my leaders to have those conversations with their personnel. And they know that every now and then, they're not going to be surprised that every now and then I'm going to come to them and say, okay, who's growing? Who's outperforming your expectations or performing to your expectations, or who's underperforming?
Yeah,
I don't want to
just
focus on the underperformers. We focus on all levels and we continue to have that conversation. Then we make sure that they're having those discussions with their staff through their one-on-ones as well.
Yeah, definitely. And maybe even skip levels once a quarter or twice a quarter if you can fit it in.
Yes, I try to do that. As you get to larger numbers, it gets to be kind of difficult with a schedule,
yeah, totally.
But I absolutely try to do that as much as I can, especially with the higher level, the folks that are at the higher levels where I could mentor them more to move them up for sure.
Yeah. So how about the notion of burnout? So you have someone who's been there a while, they've been on the same team, they've been on a cycle for what seems like forever. What do you do about that?
We try to give them another look. If they're expressing it, sometimes they don't even know that they're burning out. That's a very hard one to assess and suss out. We don't have really like a rotation schedule. I wouldn't say that I have a perfect answer for that. I think that what happens is you start to get a little comfortable in that, like, hey, this team is high performing. These four or five people are like, they're crushing it. Like, do we mess with that, right? Like, right. But through those discussions with them, those, you know, everything's got to be kind of interpersonal. You have to talk to these folks. You can't treat them like a kind of an amorphous blob, a team, a cell on a spreadsheet. You have to speak to them and you have to ask them those leading questions. Are you enjoying what you're doing? Someone has to be there and have their finger on the pulse. And then, you know, if someone's like, hey, look, this team does way more back end work and I want to get into more front end or vice versa, then we try to find them either opportunities within that team through the types of work that they take on and try to direct them towards the type of work that's more in their interest area, or we will shift them to another team. We have opportunities since we have, you know, several teams to say, hey, this team works on more on the types of work that you like or that you think you like. Why don't you go over there and try it and see? And no one fails in that sense. And then, if it doesn't work out, we'll find another opportunity for you to explore really what makes you happy. There's enough work to go around where we can give people opportunities to be a little bit experimental in what they appreciate.
Yeah, excellent. All right, let's change gears a little bit. So I like to talk about imperatives. These are things that matter to me the most, right? They differ with everybody. Everybody has their own set of imperatives, what's important to them, what they look for in people that they're going to hire or that they're going to work with, et cetera. So, you know, I can tell you some of mine, but I'd like to hear some of yours. Like, what are some of your utmost imperatives that you use now as a VP of engineering?
Hiring just in general, right? Like, it doesn't matter what level you are. What
you like? Yeah, in your operating system, what's most important to you?
Yes. Okay. The things that are more most important to me in hiring, 100% is, engineering is a very collaborative type of work. Now, that doesn't mean you can't be introverted. You absolutely can be introverted. Not everybody has to be extroverted, but it's a team sport. I believe that the most successful products are built as teams. There's very few, you know, one person teams that can build it all, and it's well documented. And so, highly collaborative, kind of team player is a must have for us in our org. You have to really want to be an engineer, I guess, and that sounds funny, but you have to. It can be a challenging work. It can be tiring to. I hope people don't hear this and shy away from engineering. It can be also very, very rewarding, but it can also be very, very solving problems all day. And some of them aren't your problems or problems that you've created. Maybe it can be challenging. It can be mentally taxing. It can be physically taxing. You know, kind of back to the burnout situation. And it does require a certain kind of, stick-to-itiveness. You know, I want to see that you have some grit and some determination to solve problems. And also some humility. Humility is very important for us.
Yeah.
Solving problems without ego. So you're solving problems all day, but you can't bring a ton of ego to the game. You really have to kind of like work with your team and seek the best ideas, not who has the best ideas. Not necessarily people in that sense. So we're really looking for people that can solve problems together, kind of have the grit and determination to do so. They do so as much as possible without ego, and they enjoy doing it. They're enjoying the life of an engineer, the career of an engineer.
Yeah, that's well said. I mean, it seems like even on the slowest day, we might solve hundreds of problems a day in an engineering type role, and in many other kinds of roles, by the way. But
sure, of course. Yeah, I didn't mean to think we're the only one solving problems.
And right, and but with especially with software developers and engineers, you're enshrining those things into systems, and then they're operating from that point forward that way. So you have to be good with living with your decisions. That's why it's so tenuous to make them too, right? So you have to make lots of right decisions all the time, and that's exhausting.
No, it's okay if you're not right. It's okay. You just have to be willing to go in and like admit that we made an assumption that didn't turn out to be true, and be ready to go solve the problem you just created. Mind you, you're doing this for typically, if you hope, you have an unpredictable user using the system that you've created, and they're going to use it in ways that you just never would have expected. And that can be surprising to some.
So going back to the outsized growth, you know, I'm looking for more stories. Do you have anybody who just was amazing in their own trajectory? Someone who ran at a pace faster than the norm?
Yeah, I honestly believe that we have two clear-cut examples at Flowcast. I'll start with our CTO. His trajectory is super interesting, and I've seen CTOs kind of start out the way that he has. But I think it's a rare breed of CTO that kind of gets it and is growing with a growing org. Oftentimes you see the org outgrowing them. So our CTO started out, pretty typical background, started out as a software engineer. He worked at MySpace for a while. And then, you know, the way he would tell the story is he kind of came out of MySpace when MySpace was kind of on the way down, and he looked around and said, "Hey, I don't want to work for someone else anymore. I want to try my hand at building software, and I want to build business software. I'm kind of done with the B2C space." And so he went out and started looking for business-minded co-founders, because he's the technical co-founder of this company. And I see oftentimes the technical co-founder of companies, once they get to a certain size, the company really kind of outgrows them. And I've been able to observe our CTO in the nearly 2 years that I've been here really, really set an example of a willingness to learn, willingness to grow, want to grow, understand his impact and influence, and understand what it is to move into a CTO role of a larger org, and how that's really part business and part tech. And I think some of the CTOs I see kind of not succeed at that level, they tend to stay with the tech. They kind of revert back to home. They end up staying in the code, and they're not really doing the business. Talk to the customer. Talk to sales. Talk to marketing. Talk to your partners. Talk to your engineering leaders. Talk to your engineers. Talk to your talk to everyone, and really understand what makes your org tick and what makes your customer tick, and then really lead from the position of being a technical business leader. And I think he's really, really excelled at that. And he's, his early, I don't want to age him. I don't know if he wants me to, yell out his age, but he, for his level of experience, he's just really, really killing it. I think on a similar level, but on the business trajectory, our CEO is a first-time CEO. He came out of Cornerstone On Demand. He was, a very high in their accounting department there. He saw this opportunity. He went out and ran with it. Serendipitously, they came together. And if you met our CEO, you'd never know he's a first-time CEO. He is tremendous. He's a tremendous fundraiser. He's a tremendous leader. He really sets a good culture. He's just a great entrepreneur, and it's just like kind of you'd expect this from somebody who's really gone through like several startups or been in several larger orgs. And so it's just really, really cool to see these two folks, and they're both here just excelling in each in their own right.
That's great. To what extent would you say they contributed to your growth?
To my personal growth here, it's been interesting. I think that they, in some ways, I'm we're all learning how to, we're all humans. I think that a lot of times when you look at like a VP or a C-level person, you're surprised that they're not infallible. That they're also humans. We're also on our career paths. We're also on our career trajectories. We're also trying new things ourselves and trying to expand our capabilities, not too unlike everybody else we spoke of in our orgs before. And, just to see them kind of figuring it out has been like, it's also actually given me like a level of confidence in willingness to kind of, go out of my comfort zone a little bit and embrace the role of an executive in a growing organization. And mind you, I came here to do that and help with that. But, you see them kind of charging down that path and actually even talking about being a senior leader and wanting to do better and admitting when they, make a mistake. They're not trying to fake it. You can see that they're practicing that they're trying to do better. They're trying to grow. They're not just like, they don't just have hubris. Like, yeah, I got this. They're really, really working at it. And that makes you want to work at it too. And it also gives you confidence that if you slip up a little bit or you make a little bit of a mistake, they're not going to just crush you for it. They're going to be there to help support you and understand and want to like course correct with you. So it's a really, really great collaborative space, and they really lead by example in that way.
That's great. I've seen a lot of successful startup environments embrace that fail fast environment and, detect and analyze and embrace failures as quickly as you can, accelerate your learning rate. You put the failure right out in the open. It's embraced, it's discussed. You get it in startups, you get it in R&D environments. If you're lucky, you get it in entrepreneuring in big companies sometimes, And so that's a really important aspect of healthy, early stage orgs where people have quite a bit of latitude and they understand just by, like you said, they led by example. So,
yeah, I mean, we talk about the fact that we're going to make tens or hundreds or thousands of decisions in our time here, right? And we don't really put a number on it. We're making a lot of decisions all day long, right? And we're not gonna bat 1,000, or let me just put it in other terms that is in the sports analogy. We're not gonna get it right all the time. You're gonna get some wrong, but you hope that you can, correct quickly, fail fast on those ones you get wrong, not dwell on it, understand how to be agile, adapt quickly. And then really the ones that the decisions you're making that are working, really know how to like be a catalyst for those, promoting those and promulgating those to the org and really, really embracing those. So it's a game of, you know, decisions, and hope you make more good ones than bad ones, and really capitalizing on the good ones and learning from them, from the ones that aren't, that didn't work out so well.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. So let's change gears one more time. I want to talk about awkward interview experiences, either ones you've taken or given. So if you have any examples that we could all learn from, because I mean, we could talk about successful interviewing experiences, but it's like, and then I got the job, or, and then whatever, but I want to hear about ones where maybe you were unfairly interviewed, or maybe you had, you know, you don't have to name any candidates, but if you had any awkward candidate experiences, that's what I want to talk about.
Oh, I've interviewed so much. Like, I think that the most awkward interviews that I've been in, and it happens every now and then. I understand that, you know, this happens in orgs, but you know, when you get into an interview and you're kind of their guinea pig for them figuring out what they want, and it, and they don't really know what they're looking for. And, you're kind of helping them shape it. Right. So like I've gone in for interviews, you know, say for say I'm a VP, I'm going in for a VP role interview or even a manager level interview. And that's what they have listed. And, you know, it comes out, somehow in the interview that like, hey, we're not really sure what we want here. And then you don't get the job because they've somehow changed the it's a moving target, right? So it's like a VP level role, and then they're like, hey, you know, that's great, but we decided we don't want a VP, we want a director level person. So now you're either too expensive or overqualified, and so thanks but no thanks, or vice versa. They move the goalpost up. So those are I think to me like some of the most awkward scenarios where it's really obvious partway through the interview that you know, they don't know what they want, and you shouldn't be there, and they probably shouldn't be interviewing. It's not a funny anecdote, but I see it happen a lot of times, and that's why, you know, when we're trying to put something together, we're very thoughtful about our need, and we don't go out with a role unless we feel like we have a need, and we have a need at a level, and then we try to fit for that. I have one where a guy fell asleep in my interview.
Let's talk about that then. Okay, I got to know what happens after they wake up, though. So.
No, I'm serious. So it was a long time ago. I was interviewing for a software engineer, like a senior software engineer role, and it was a company I really wanted to work for in Denver. I won't name them. I think they're still around. And I was just so excited to even get the interview, and the person that was interviewing me was kind of like, you know, I knew of him, I'd never met him, and so I was very much kind of, I felt very prepared for this interview and ready to go in and like just kind of like knock the socks off of this person, and turns out he had just returned from like Australia or, you know, somewhere overseas that when he was like, this is what his story, he was pretty severely jet lagged, and quite literally he would ask me a question and I'd be going through my answer and he would fall asleep in his chair.
Oh man.
And so like I'm like, I don't know, I'm 20 something, I'm this is like the most important thing in the world to me, he's falling asleep and he's getting up and he's walking around the room, he's calling a secretary like, hey,
oh man,
coffee or whoever, an admin, I forget who it was. So, you know, he's really like throw a bucket of water on me. He's like, and he's not hiding and he's like tired, but he just keeps falling asleep. And I just think I'm doing terribly. I leave the interview. I go back to the recruiter and I'm like, hey, there's no way I got that job. Like I was putting that guy to sleep, and they made me an offer, but I didn't take it because I didn't want to work for someone that would fall asleep in my interview.
Right. How you do one thing's how you do everything, huh?
Yeah.
I tell other people I've interviewed about 120 times in 10 years. It's a long story, but it was a project and a fun thing I did. And I got to know the whole market around me at all times.
Wow.
And so, and it started about 3 months before I graduated from Chico. So I interviewed at a bunch of those in NorCal pretty much. And I learned something right away as an early candidate into the tech market, which was don't stack your interviews too close. Because I went to an interview once for some like hotel TV company or whatever down in the South, down in the Silicon Valley. And they're like, yeah, well, you know, I didn't realize when they stack an interview up to lunch, they probably want to take you out to lunch if it goes well. And I had to basically bolt up to the Mission District to do another interview right after that. And actually, they never called me back. They were so upset that they couldn't take me to lunch and that I was interviewing aggressively. You know, I thought it would just send a signal that I'm, you know, I'm a serious candidate.
I'm sought after.
Yeah, exactly. But to them, they actually put on a big sad face and like I didn't hear back from. I mean, maybe that's not the only thing, but I learned like to stack my time a little better and stuff.
Yeah.
When it comes up on lunch, you know,
that's very important. Like I'm sure the Bay Area. But around here as well in LA, like it's very hard to get from one interview to the next, I'm sure. So
yeah, you afford an hour or two. Really. Yeah. Somebody said LA is only 2 hours away from LA.
Yeah, that's true.
So, all right. Well, thanks for coming on, Amit. This has been great. I appreciate your time and your conversation. It's really cool to hear how you move through your career and how people grow within your org. So that's great stuff. Thank you very much.
Thank you. It's my pleasure. And I appreciate, this is fun for me too. And I appreciate being to help out and I love to be, you know, I love to have the content as well. So it's really cool. And I appreciate that you're doing this. It's a really cool thing that you do, these blogs and the podcasts and stuff to help the community and everything.